Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Sharif Abdul-Quddus, Middle East and North Africa editor with Dropsite News, who examines the devastating impact of Israel's Gaza starvation policy on more than 2 million Palestinian civilians. Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a former CIA analyst, who warns that Trump's Golden Dome National Missile Defense System is unachievable, destabilizing, and a waste of taxpayer dollars. And Scarlett De Leon, executive director of ACT LA, who talks about her group's effort to enlist the Los Angeles Metropolitan Transportation Authority to strengthen protections for the city's immigrants against ICE abductions. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Trump Department of Justice is making unprecedented demands for state voter registration lists and to inspect voting machines, threatening to withhold grants and other funds from uncooperative states. These requests for sensitive data on millions of Americans in nine states has raised concerns among both Democratic and Republican local officials that the Trump regime is now planning to interfere in the 2026 midterm elections. Stateline News and The Washington Post observe that for years, Trump has advanced false claims about rigged elections, including the accusation his defeat in the 2020 election was due to massive voter fraud. Trump and his allies have promoted the lie that large numbers of undocumented immigrants are voting in U.S. elections, as the regime ignores due process and the rule of law to carry out mass deportations. As Trump and the Republican Party's poll numbers decline, Democrats are hoping to take control of the House and chip away at the GOP majority in the Senate in the 2016 midterm election. Election officials fear the administration could be planning to impose new rules that would purge large numbers of eligible voters from the rolls and make it harder for Trump's opponents to cast ballots. A severe shortage of firefighters is hampering the U.S. Forest Service's ability to fight wildfires in the Pacific Northwest and mountain states, including Utah, Nevada, and Wyoming. One quarter of all federal firefighting positions, including many in senior leadership, are now unfilled. The Guardian reports that the issue has come into sharper focus as the Trump administration continues to slash budgets and cut support staff positions, causing morale to plummet among crews battling wildfires. Firefighters and forest experts express deep concerns that the drastic cuts and resignation incentives offered earlier this year, which terminated thousands, have left crews dangerously unprepared. A program designed by Trump and DOGE to rapidly shrink the federal government resulted in 4,800 Forest Service workers accepting a deal for paid administrative leave through September if they opted to resign or retire. At a recent U.S. Senate hearing, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden confronted Forest Service Chief Tom Schultz about major staffing cuts in the middle of a very dangerous fire season, where the climate crisis is fueling a new era of catastrophic fires. Angry protests swept across Mexico City in July, decrying the gentrification and rising rents in the capital city. Anger turned into violence as activists vandalized storefronts of brand symbols of gentrification, like Starbucks and Airbnb rental apartments. The Guardian reports that anti-gentrification protests reflect growing resentment in cities around the world, including Mexico City, Barcelona, Genoa, and Lisbon, where rising rents are blamed on tourists and foreigners who took over housing during the COVID pandemic, pushing out local working families and young residents. Mexico's president, Claudia Sheinbaum, condemned the protesters lashing out as xenophobic. She maintained that no matter how legitimate the demand, in this case gentrification, we can't just say out to any nationality in our country. A National Academy of Sciences study found rents in Mexico City had increased 400 to 800% over the last 20 years. But the study also concluded that gentrification has been caused by government policies, where Mexico City had the lowest rate of new housing construction between 2010 and 2020 of any state in the country. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Israel's 21-month-long war in Gaza has killed more than 60,000 Palestinians, mostly civilian women and children. Israel's months-long blockade of virtually all humanitarian aid into Gaza has resulted in severe shortages of basic food and medical supplies. A United Nations-affiliated organization that tracks food security worldwide issued a dire alert on July 29th, confirming that a worst-case famine scenario is now unfolding across the Gaza Strip. Every day there are new reports of Palestinians dying of starvation and malnutrition. Reacting to growing international pressure on Israel to end its policy of starving Gaza's 2.3 million residents, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced on July 27th a halt in military operations 10 hours a day in parts of Gaza to allow a trickle of humanitarian aid to be delivered, but he continued to deny anyone in Gaza was starving. Soon after, Jordan and the United Arab Emirates began to airdrop supplies. However, the UN World Food Program responded by declaring the supplies now coming into Gaza were entirely inadequate to address the crisis. During a July 28th press conference in Scotland, President Trump acknowledged for the first time the reality of Gaza's starvation crisis. Meanwhile, two Israeli human rights groups, B'Tselem and Physicians for Human Rights Israel, have accused their government of committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. Your reporter spoke with Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Middle East and North Africa editor with Dropsite News, who discusses his recent reports on the starvation crisis in Gaza.
You know, Israel has restricted food into Gaza for many, many years, and ramped it up at the beginning of the war on October 7th, 2023. And so we've seen malnutrition and hunger grow over the past 21 months. But what has happened recently, starting on March 2nd, Israel imposed a full-spectrum blockade, allowing in no food, no fuel, no medicine, no humanitarian aid whatsoever into Gaza. In late May, May 27th, they began allowing in meager amounts of aid, something like 60 to 70 trucks a day. This is a place where humanitarian experts say at least 500 to 600 trucks a day are needed at a minimum. And they let it in through a new system that was overseen by a U.S. and Israeli-backed group called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, as well as some trucks that went in by the U.N. And what is happening right now is that we've reached a tipping point. Because of this complete siege and lack of food, there's simply nothing to eat. And people now are beginning to starve to death. Just on Sunday, the World Health Organization said there have been 63 malnutrition-related deaths and starvation deaths in Gaza this month alone, including 24 children under the age of five. Compare that to 11 deaths from the 6 months prior. So we've reached a tipping point that was entirely preventable, that was predicted by food experts and famine experts, and that is the result of a deliberate policy. People talk about this being a humanitarian crisis. It is not. This is a policy of starvation with the intention of ethnic cleansing. The stated aims by different Israeli ministers, including the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. And the people who now are trying to get these meager rations, the little aid that is there, are forced to travel to mostly the deep south of Gaza, to militarized zones where they are shot and shelled and attacked on a daily basis. It is really a low for humanity. And, you know, some people talk about, well, there's other places in the world where there is hunger and famine. And that's true. In Sudan, South Sudan, Haiti, these are places where groups say there's the highest level of concern outside of Gaza. And these places are all suffering terribly. But Gaza is exceptional for two reasons. Firstly, the percentage of the population affected in these places. So, for example, in Sudan and South Sudan and Yemen, where starvation is present, something like 50 to 50% of the population is at risk. In Gaza, the share is 100%. The risk of famine is total. This is highly unusual historically, and it's because you have a trapped population that is subject to a deliberate policy of starvation. And also in these other places like Sudan and South Sudan, you know, there's a civil war. Haiti's in anarchy and so on. The difference again here is that the famine is a result of a deliberate policy by a rich, well-armed state. Food supplies are being deliberately withheld. There's 900 trucks waiting to get into Gaza that can't get in. Water desalination plants and other facilities are being intentionally bombed, so people are parched and dehydrated. There's no fuel for cooking. All the agriculture has been systematically destroyed. So the death by starvation in Gaza that is happening now is not the unintended consequence of some obscure amorphous crisis. It's the result of deliberate policy that was predicted, and it's happening right now, live-streamed famine before our eyes.
Thank you, Sharif. What is it going to take, do you think, for the United States to reverse course here? The entire world is well aware of Joe Biden and Donald Trump's role in this horrendous loss of life and the ethnic cleansing campaign that Trump himself basically stoked with his idea he was going to drive out the Palestinian population of Gaza and create a Middle East Riviera with expensive condos in Gaza. It's hard to imagine how the United States can repair its image to the world as part of this genocide.
Yeah, I think this will have repercussions for generations to come. What does it take? It would take a phone call from President Trump to stop this and to allow any aid. If we look, if history is any teacher, Israel is the proxy of the United States, not the other way around. Every time Israel has been forced to end a war, it's been because the United States has forced it to do so, not because Israel wanted it to end. We saw the day before President Trump was inaugurated, it took one visit by Steve Witkoff to Jerusalem to force Netanyahu to sign a ceasefire. And we saw the longest ceasefire that we've seen so far since the beginning of the war take hold on January 19th. Israel violated it multiple times, then imposed the siege on March 2nd, and then resumed its genocidal assault on March 18th. And Trump allowed that to happen. But that's all it took.
That was Sharif Abdul-Qaddous, Middle East and North Africa editor with DropSite News. Find links to his recent article titled "Palestinians Are Collapsing in Gaza Streets from Israeli Imposed Starvation Campaign" and related news and commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Not long after Donald Trump returned to the White House, he announced a grandiose and unrealistic plan, dubbed the Golden Dome National Missile Defense System, that he claims will be operational by the end of his term in office in 2028. Trump is resurrecting President Ronald Reagan's failed Star Wars program, or Strategic Defense Initiative of the 1980s, that envisaged a network of space-based lasers and missile interceptors that could shoot down missiles launched by the Soviet Union targeting U.S. cities. After spending billions of dollars, the technology was deemed unfeasible and the project was eventually scrapped. Today, Trump's plan will cost an estimated $175 to $542 billion over two decades. Although missile defense technology has improved over the past 40 years, so have the cheap countermeasures adversaries could employ to overwhelm and knock out the U.S. system. Your reporter spoke with Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, a former CIA analyst and author. Here he talks about his recent commentary titled "The Waste and Futility of the Golden Dome National Defense System," where he explains how a new, even unworkable U.S. missile defense system will likely create instability among nuclear-armed states, leading some non-nuclear nations to build their own nuclear arsenals.
There are three factors that have to be considered when you're discussing national missile defense. One, it's not workable. And we know that from tests. And I remember playing war games at the National War College, and the assumption was that national missile defense wasn't workable because no one has ever found a system, despite all of the money thrown at research, and there's still billions of dollars every year going into missile defense research, and I don't think people know about that. It's such a small part of the defense budget. There's never been a system that could tell the difference between a decoy and an actual missile. And if a country is good enough to launch a missile at an intercontinental range, and that's what now North Korea is working on, developing chaff to fool the system and developing decoys would be no problem whatsoever. And even though the Pentagon likes to talk about the tests, there are successful tests. Whenever I was involved at the National War College and did some work on this, because I was also intelligence advisor to the SALT-1 and ABM talks in Vienna in 1972, those tests were rigged. The system knew could allow for what was a decoy and what was an actual missile. So it's not workable. I don't think it's affordable. It's going to drive out all sorts of spending, not only in the defense area, but outside of defense. And it's totally unnecessary, because I think what most countries, well, the nuclear countries, have realized that it's a lot cheaper not to try to build a national missile defense, which is very expensive. You can easily overwhelm it with offensive missiles. And I think that's what the Soviets decided. And now under Putin, that's what the Russians have decided. No one ever really talks about the strategic impact that this would have. In the past, it drew Russia and China closer together. This happened during the Reagan 80s, but it's much closer now in terms of their relationship. The European allies won't be happy with this because they've always had this fear of decoupling, that the United States would always protect itself, but it would never protect Europe. And if we had a national defense, particularly if we thought it worked, there would be that fear that we were decoupling from Europe. And when you have Donald Trump as a president who doesn't have a lot of respect for Europe to begin with and has taken steps that suggested decoupling in other areas, particularly with regard to Ukraine, it's already forced them to enter into their own arrangements, including nuclear discussions between Britain and France. When I've written about this, I've also talked about how it would weaken the nonproliferation regime. If we're going to go ahead and build a national missile defense, which I say is unworkable, it's going to encourage other countries who have nuclear weapons to build more. And my fear is, and my concern would be, that it may attract countries that have not shown a real interest in nuclear weapons to go nuclear. And at the top of my list would be a country like South Korea, which from time to time has talked about having nuclear weapons. Japan's another possibility, even though I think the Constitution as currently written prescribes the idea of nuclear weapons.
Mel, I did want to ask you, given the Golden Dome, this national missile defense system's limitations or the technical issues that will prevent it from working effectively to protect the U.S. from incoming missiles, why do it? There are certainly engineers and scientists who are advising the Pentagon who know full well that cheap decoys will overwhelm a system, no matter how sophisticated, as you pointed out. So why do this? Is this some kind of propaganda that Trump has dreamed up? I mean, this is not just Trump, I guess we should say. This is a long-running sort of stream of thought from Ronald Reagan all the way to today. But why do it?
Well, I think the answer there, to go back to President Dwight David Eisenhower and his farewell address in 1961, is you have to factor in the military-industrial complex. And when I think of the money that goes into missile defense, you're talking about five major defense contractors: Raytheon, Boeing, TRW, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman. They give a lot of money to politicians, particularly to Republican politicians who support national missile defense. So the scientists and experts, and we have many of them, as you say, with excellent resumes, I don't think it counts for very much because of the it's the corporate influence and the money that corporations garner on the basis of our defense budget.
That was Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, and a former CIA analyst. Find a link to Goodman's commentary titled "The Waste and Futility of the Golden Dome National Defense System and Related Analysis" by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Los Angeles is a city of immigrants, where one in three Angelenos were born outside the U.S. It's also a sanctuary city, with protections in place for migrants since the Central America immigrant surge of the 1980s. One of those protections stipulates that no employee of the Metropolitan Transit Authority should cooperate with federal enforcement agencies like ICE unless specific conditions are met. Immigrants in L.A. depend on the public transportation system to get to work, school, and anywhere else they need to go. The group ACT LA organizes low-income residents around housing and transportation justice issues. In June, after ICE raids led to the arrests of hundreds of immigrants in Los Angeles, the group sent a letter to the LA County Metropolitan Transportation Authority asking for changes to strengthen protections for immigrants against ICE abductions. Those changes included continuing transit service during protests and distribution of Know Your Rights cards on buses and at rail stations. The group also asked for all Metro Transit employees to be trained in what to do if ICE agents show up at a station, bus stop, or on board a transit vehicle without a warrant. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Scarlett De Leon, executive director of ACT LA, who elaborates on what her group is asking of LA's Metropolitan Transportation Authority.
We've had heavy ICE presence in the city of Los Angeles these last few months. They've been terrorizing our city, kidnapping folks without any due process, targeting areas where a lot of workers are, Latino workers are at, street vendors, where street vendors sell, areas like MacArthur Park, which is heavily Latino, and also Home Depots to target day laborers, etc. So they're really targeting hardworking community folks. And these folks are also the ones that rely on public transportation. 8 out of 10 riders are low-income, working-class folks who rely on the bus system here in Los Angeles to get to essential services like work, school, churches, medical service, etc. We see our community, the riders we talk to, really afraid. A lot of street vendors are not going out to vend, really losing their day income. And we're talking about folks who rely on this income, you know, who need every single day of income in order to pay for their essentials like rent and transportation. The way they move is in public, is through the metro system. So that leaves them in many ways vulnerable. But it's also an opportunity for Metro to stand in solidarity. And I see that in two ways. One, in the communications that Metro does, like actually verbally standing with the immigrant community of Los Angeles in action, taking actual steps to protect all riders to be safe. Metro has been doing a pretty good job at posting using like their social media platforms in standing in solidarity with riders and the immigrant community, but also rolling out a Know Your Rights campaign, which is one of the things that we really wanted to see. And we were asking also for folks to be able to access Know Your Rights cards on the system in different languages. And then also wanting Metro staff to be trained on what to do if an ICE agent comes in, like what are the rights of riders and how do we keep writers physically safe in the presence of ICE agents. So one of the like the concrete asks we had is for no tap to exit. So right now in some of the systems, they were starting to implement tap to exit where you tap your card to pay to go into the system and then you had to tap it to get out of the system. And this was a way to really enforce fares, but it is a way potentially for folks to be trapped within Metro and to be not able to get out if ICE agents were to show up.
And then another one was interesting. Ensure service operates as regularly scheduled during protests and curfew hours so as not to leave anyone stranded and in potential danger of arrest. So it sounds like some of these six things, maybe have they already happened, or are these all things that you want to see that don't exist yet?
They're all happening at different levels. So the Know Your Rights information, we just today spotting them out in the system. We haven't really noticed cards, so I need to follow up with that. But I know there was a plan to start dispersing cards, Know Your Rights cards. In terms of the turnstiles, I believe currently three stations that have the tap to exit, and one of them, it's locked tap to exit, and the other two are currently awaiting fire department approval. And we want to make sure that regardless of when the fire department approval comes in, that those turnstiles are not locked until we can be guaranteed that ICE presence and federal agents have left the city. So during the big mass mobilizations, the protests that the city saw against ICE agents and against the federal administration, the city enforced curfews in downtown Los Angeles, like that downtown areas where the protests were taking place, and Metro stopped running their system in those areas, leaving many folks stranded who had really chosen to take public transportation to these peaceful protests where they were exercising their rights.
That was Scarlett De Leon, Executive Director of ACT LA. Learn more about the group's advocacy for strengthening immigrant protections on the Los Angeles public transit system by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFA in Jamestown, New York, KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, KGHI in Westport, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.